Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. The program that you're about to watch was filmed in the Caribbean aboard the New Amsterdam during the National Review post-election cruise. That is just a few days after the election of November 2012. Uncommon Knowledge, a production of the Hoover Institution, today at sea with National Review. Shooting during the National Review post-election cruise, Uncommon Knowledge today. Are we or are we not doomed? John O'Sullivan and Jonah Goldberg. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Editor-at-large of National Review, British subject John O'Sullivan served during the 1980s as special advisor and speechwriter to Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. He is the author of O'Sullivan's First Rule, which holds that all organizations that are not actually right-wing will, over time, become left-wing. Is there a second rule, John?
There is, but I think it's never order decaffeinated espresso in a multicultural society. But
he is also the author of a brilliant volume on the end of the Cold War, The President, the Pope, and the Prime Minister, Three Who Changed the World. Jonah Goldberg is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and the founding editor of National Review Online. Jonah is the author of the best-selling books Liberal Fascism, The Secret History of the American Left, and The Tyranny of Clichés. John, Jonah, welcome. Do you have a rule, Jonah? Goldberg's first rule?
I don't have a rule. I wish I had known to prepare a rule.
There's but, time.
It'll
there's
come
time.
To me. It'll
there's
come
time.
To me.
There's time. Segment one, what went wrong? November 6th, 57th election for the presidency of the United States, Republican Mitt Romney lost to Democrat Barack Obama by 58.8 to 62.1 million votes, or by 47.8% to 50.6%, or by 206 votes in the Electoral College to 332. Jonah Goldberg, quote, "The progressives won," close quote. Explain.
Right. Well, first of all, there's an entirely legitimate argument to make that this was a very close election and Mitt Romney had a bad day, and it was, if you just had it on a different day and swung some votes in some key swing states, everything would have been fine.
Jim Garrity, National Review, notes that a change of only 407,000 votes across four states would have changed the outcome in the Electoral College. So it's 407,000 votes out of 120 million cast.
Right. There's that argument to be made. The problem is that the coming demographic change and the branding problems that the Republican Party faced and that people have been talking about for a very long time, they came a little earlier than reality would have dictated, right? I mean, technically, there were enough of the Republican coalition white voters for Mitt Romney to have won if it hadn't been such a badly run campaign, badly conceived campaign, and if the Obama campaign hadn't been so good. That said, the problems that faced the Romney campaign were a preview of the more real structural changes coming down the pike. And so what I meant by the progressives have won is that the voters that Barack Obama was going for, that he relied on in his coalition, not all of them to be sure, but by far the winning margin, were single women, young people, minorities, Hispanics. Let's leave Hispanics out of it for 2 seconds. The nation of Julias, in effect. You know, Barack Obama had this ad where this campaign website about appealing to young women who very clearly have no connection to civil society to speak of. They don't have significant families to speak of. They don't rely on the mediating institutions or the little platoons, as Edmund Burke would say. And instead, they are appealable to this argument that government is their sense of community. And that has been a 100-year project of the progressives, to diminish and delegitimize the authority and the sovereignty of the family, to clear away the mediating institutions in society to an effect, to the sense where all that is left is the individual and the state. As Woodrow Wilson put it, the point of progressivism is to have the individual marry his interest to the state.
And why do you use the term progressive instead of liberal? To make the historical point, because Woodrow Wilson called himself a progressive?
Largely, yeah, and also it just drives me crazy that we call progressives liberals. I mean, give that word back to the libertarians. And to point out simply that this is a long, ongoing project.
The republic may be lost, but you're going to reclaim the word liberal.
Yes, I will cling to whatever small life raft of vindication I can.
Okay, John, Jonah's analysis?
Well, first of all, I agree with it with qualifications. I'll come back to that. I think the progressives won in another sense, and I think Jonah will agree with this, that is within the Democratic Party, the progressive wing has defeated the conservative wing. And now you have an extraordinary case in which at the end of the Obama administration, you'll have the progressives led by someone, I don't know who, versus the Clintonites. But Mrs. Clinton is the progressive wing of the Clinton family. So it's going to be a very interesting development. Now, where I agree with Jonah, and agree with him very strongly, in fact, I'll go further. If you go back to 1997, I wrote a piece saying that if the ethnic balances in the American electorate were the same then, as they had been in the previous 25 years, the Republicans would have lost most of the elections between 72 and 96. And looking ahead, National Review used the phrase first, actually, an emerging Democratic majority was coming online. And it was coming online for all the reasons that Jonah gave, though I think in that analysis we didn't stress single women so much as we would today. Where I would add a qualification is this. First of all, yes, the ethnic balance of the electorate is going against the Republicans, which means, in common sense terms, that they have to get more votes from ethnic groups, of course. But first of all, it's not, and it's going to get worse. But for the next two or maybe four elections, actually, the white vote will still be the big voting enchilada. There was 73% of the electorate, the voters, this time, and they won't lose the majority position. Well, actually, Michael Barone argues, and I think I agree with them, they may never lose it, because the fact is, we talk of Hispanics, but Hispanics are mostly white. And secondly, yes, so half the Hispanics are actually white. And secondly, those who are not white in the sense that Sicilians were not white. And if you look at what's happened to Italians...
Repeat that point. Not white in the sense that Sicilians are not white.
Yeah.
Well, meaning it's cultural rather than...
No, I mean, if you go back to the turn of the 19th century, to the 20th century, you'll see that the WASPs and the old line Protestants in America thought of Southern Europeans as being somehow a different race. Okay. And they blended quite quickly into the the great American white electorate, and then subsequently, of course...
Can we stay on that historical point for a moment? Because you mentioned, you were saying, if the proportions had been what they are now then, you remind me, back in the old days, in the early 1980s, when I was on the vice president's staff, there was a man right across the hall from me called John Morgan, who was a brilliant political analyst. I don't know what's become of him since. This was the day before computers, and he had map after map after map of the United States, enormous ones, in which he had colored in with colored pencil, county by county, the results going back a century and a half. So it was a kind of, we're all used to seeing these county by county maps. And John made the point that the Republican Party, even in 1980, remained the party of Plymouth Rock, and the Democratic Party was the party of Ellis Island, which is to say that the Republican Party had never appealed in any compelling or comprehensive way to any immigrant group after the original founders. The Republican Party was largely the middle of the country. It was still largely Protestant. You could talk until you were blue in the face about the Reagan Catholics. They moved over. But fundamentally, the Republican Party took decades appealing to Italians, still hasn't won over Jews. Why is that? Why does this party find it so hard to reach out beyond that historic white base?
The rise of the Michael Novak wrote a book, I think it was, came out in 66, called about the unmeltable ethnics. Mm. And these are the groups you're talking about, the white ethnics who never melded into the great white Protestant Republican majority, so to speak. But they did. They did in 1980. As his book came out, first Nixon and then Reagan got them to join.
Finally the Italians join.
That's right. Well, people get older, they die, their sons and daughters marry out, they get better jobs, they cease to think of themselves as Poles, as Italians.
And this is why Barack Obama just carried the Cubans in Miami.
that's, they're going the other way.
Well, that's, but if you think about it this way, do people become Americans? That's the real problem. Where Jonah and I might differ is he was, when we've talked about this, he's seen the appeal to, let's say, the Mexican votes or the others as being appeals based on similar social values. Mm. I don't see it that way. I see that the way we will get the Hispanics and the other groups, the Asians, as part of the Republican coalition is to get them first part of the Great American Coalition. Make them think of themselves, not make, but persuade them to think of themselves primarily as Americans. Restore the overarching, all-encompassing concept of an American identity, which we used to have, which we knew how to bring about, and which in the last 20 or 30 years, very largely as a result of the Democrats wanting to emphasize ethnicity rather than Americanness, we have lost that. And frankly, one of the reasons we haven't regained it and are doing very badly at the moment is because the Republicans have neither had the imagination nor the courage to think how they could appeal to these other ethnic groups as Americans and craft an appeal that won them over. They've got to do that.
I actually agree with John on a lot of that. And I think that, and this is one of the, you know, one of the real challenges is, let's put it this way. Sean Trend at Real Clear Politics makes a very compelling point, is that the reason why Hispanics are overwhelmingly Democratic isn't because of some Demeistrian ironclad ethnic identity that they can't break out of the iron cage. It's because they're wildly disproportionately low income. And low income people tend to be Democrats. And as Hispanics get more middle class, they become almost indistinguishable in the data from the typical American voter. Doesn't mean they all become Republicans, but they tend to go one way or the other. There's a huge bulge in the snake of low-income people that are Hispanics, which would be understandable.
And that's the critical factor.
And that's the more important. And that's why I'm so skeptical of this idea of just throwing out a blanket amnesty or figuring out a way, some path to citizenship, saying that somehow we'll buy their loyalties. On policy grounds and on sort of moral grounds, I would love to come up with some solution to this thing.
Right.
But as a political matter, I don't know that they just wouldn't, first of all, pocket this and say thank you very much, but I'm still voting Democrat because I like these social service programs and all the rest.
Jonah, let's listen to two quotations.
I agree with that as it happens too, by the way.
Jonah, listen to two quotations. Quotation number one, John O'Sullivan. Most Hispanics are white. Intermarriage is creating mixed and non-racial identities that further confuse ethnic categories. One effect could be an electorate that votes less and less along ethnic lines. That's quotation number one by John O'Sullivan. Here's quotation two, John O'Sullivan. There is a darker possibility. That possibility is that whites will develop a defensive minority consciousness in response to their statistically weaker position. A white hunkering down and a sharpening of ethnic divisions. Which are you going to vote for? O'Sullivan A or O'Sullivan B?
Well, I mean, I think O'Sullivan A is obviously the rosier scenario, but I mean, John wouldn't be an elder statesman of conservatism if he wasn't pointing out the potential for a darker scenario. I mean, that's what conservatives do. But this sort of gets to a fundamental point, you know, is that in all this talk about immigration and Hispanics, we don't have an immigration problem in this country. To the extent we have an immigration problem, we have a problem in how we're dealing with immigration from Mexico.
Which has now stopped.
Temporarily, and hopefully forever.
I was going to ask, remember, Peter Brimelow, what was Peter's book, John, on immigration?
Alienation.
Alienation. And Peter Brimelow said, during the two big periods of immigration, there was a long breathing spell afterwards. And I was going to do you think we're in for such a breathing spell? Maybe the worst of this problem is over.
As long as the only reason there's a breathing spell now is because the economy is so bad.
Mm. Well, but aside from the drug war in Mexico, behind that drug war in Mexico, apparently Mexico's actually growing quite handily. It's turned an economic corner.
That is the ultimate solution. If Mexico got rich very quickly, that would be very good for everybody.
Yes. Right. That's if you handle it from that side. In other words, people don't come if the economy isn't attractive to them.
Right.
But there's also another aspect to this, which is that if we could get the immigration to be not simply more skilled, but also more various. If people came from a lot of different countries so that they didn't all speak the same non-English language, everybody in those circumstances basically has to learn English to get on and to understand each other. And so we need a more varied immigration input.
John, you made this very arresting argument that what we need to do is reassert a sense of Americanness. All right. Bill Schneider, political analyst Bill Schneider, on election night, quote, "What we are seeing here is a race between the old America and the new America. The old America is white men like Mitt Romney. The new America is winning. It's young people, it's minorities, it's foreign-born Americans, it's women, it's sexual minorities, it's racial minorities. It's a whole new demography that has just managed to win," close quote. The notion here is that the very sense of what it means to be an American is now in play. And it could well be that people who sympathize with the so-called new America say, well, yes, as a matter of fact, O'Sullivan, you're quite right. We do need to assert a sense of Americanness. It's just not quite what you think of as American. It's what we think of as American.
And what would that be, Peter? What would be the notion of an America or an Americanness that was not an identity, even an identity that recognized subordinate and other identities, but was, you were one kind of American, I was another, he was a third. We had different histories, different views of the country. We speak different languages. We don't always communicate with each other for that reason very well.
It's incoherent, isn't it?
Candidates are running for election, they address one community saying one thing and another community saying another. How long does democratic debate retain any kind of reality if people, if you have a Quebec where it's all in French and the rest of the country doesn't follow it, and a Canada where the Quebecois don't follow it? Now, that's the kind of future that could emerge from the idea of a new America that is somehow totally distinct from the old one. But remember, the existing America, it started out with a group of English Protestants. It took in the Irish, the Germans. It took in the Italians. It's taken in all of the groups since then. And on each occasion, you've looked, the process has begun by looking like a group of squabbling nationalities. And it's ended as everyone has gradually been absorbed into this respect for the same institutions, for the same language, and roughly speaking, for the same set of ideas. I don't see why that process, which, by the way, Americanization was never an easy process. There was a certain amount of pressure. Norman Podhoretz used the phrase the brutal bargain, in which the immigrant surrendered something of his original identity, not his religion, not his food, in return for being part of the whole. And I think the same will happen again if the Americans want that and if the majority wants it.
Yeah, the problem, and this is one of the reasons why I wrote the column about how the progressives have won. Historically, I think it's sort of fascinating. Historically, ethnic groups, minorities, immigrant groups that have seen their collective prosperity as bound up in government have done vastly worse, and it's taken much slower, right?
Right.
Think of African Americans, think of the Irish who got caught up in political machines and all that, versus Asian Americans of all the various, you know, subgroups, or Italian Americans who kept a distance. It turns out that you get prosperity much quicker if you just sort of don't try to have your model as some sort of rent-seeking relationship to government. The problem is that particularly with the Mexican immigration problem, which is a distinct thing because we share a border. We didn't share a border with Ireland. We didn't share a border with Italy. The way the Democratic Party approaches this ethnic group is precisely to stretch out that assimilation process as long as conceivably possible by convincing these people against their own better instincts, because they're such hardworking people, to lay down their bets with government against the sort of classic model of what the Koreans or the Jews or the other successful minorities have done. And there's such a large number of them. I mean, people talk about Hispanics, but of the, what is it, 80 million Hispanics or something like that, 68 million are Mexican Americans, right. You know, and so it's a real challenge, because that's the Democratic Party thinks that's what the new America is treating these people as if they are, clients of the state.
Right. Before November 6th recedes too quickly into the background, let's take just a moment.
I don't think it can recede quickly enough, frankly.
All right. Well, let's take just a moment to examine this argument that maybe it wasn't that decisive. Maybe we didn't learn much at all. Jonah Goldberg, quote, "I'll be blunt. I do not think that Mitt Romney ran a good campaign," close quote.
I think it's transparently true. I think he ran hard. He was dedicated.
Well,
he
let's stipulate. All that stuff, we're right? saying nothing against Mitt Romney. Okay. He's a good man. We all respect the effort. But go ahead.
Okay, so presidents in the so there's a whole debate about whether or not Barack Obama was this exception to the rule, or if he really was this sort of this new paradigm emerged with Obama. But for 40 years, the Republican Party had an advantage at the presidential level. This was a center-right country. The only two Democrats to win were Jimmy Carter, evangelical Christian from the South, military veteran, all that, and Bill Clinton, who didn't even get a majority, but was nonetheless ran for welfare reform, ran against the left, had his sister soldier stuff for the death penalty. And Barack Obama was the first guy to come along who, first of all, ran as an unapologetic liberal and never pivoted back to the center.
Right.
And it was because of the exhaustion with George Bush. It was because of the financial crisis. It was because John McCain was not a great candidate either. And along comes Mitt Romney, who's got this theory of the race that takes none of that into account and basically says, if we can just convince these 6 million people who voted, who we think we can get them to vote for us now, who voted for Barack Obama the last time, we win. We now know that they didn't even really care about trying to get the people who voted for John McCain last time.
Yeah.
If just the people who voted for John McCain last time voted for Romney, Romney would have won. And there was no ideology in the campaign. There were no big ideas in the campaign. Not a single primetime speaker at the Republican convention used the word liberal once. It was like they were afraid of being conservative.
How is just this one statistic that it just seems to me inexplicable? Is that John McCain got 70% of the Mormon vote, and Mitt Romney, a Mormon, got 68%.
I can't explain it.
Yeah. It is inexplicable.
It is inexplicable. First of all, we're not doomed. The long-term, we're people who are climbing, who are going up a down escalator. And it is certainly, unfortunately, it's a shallow down escalator. You know, it's not going very rapidly. Secondly, the campaign was a terrible campaign. There's no doubt about that. I thought he could win, and I hoped he would win, and I respect him personally. But he wasn't.
By the way, can I just, neither of you feels that even the slightest impulse to apologize for a conservative, that he ran a too conservative a campaign. He was too far to the right. You're not going to buy that for a nanosecond.
That is nonsense.
All right.
He explained some conservative positions badly, and so people say, aha, he's too conservative. No, he explained some perfectly reasonable, fairly successful conservative ideas in a way that made him sound like a psychopath.
Sorry,
his basic argument was, the country's going to hell in a handbasket economically. I'm the man who knows how to solve it. Well, he was, I think, a bad candidate, not by activity, but, so to speak, by simply being who he was that if you look at the electorate, one big swing vote that has been tantalizingly close to becoming a Republican one since Ronald Reagan is the white working class. And that's been driven into the Republicans' arms by the inattention and even hostility of the Democrats on such issues as affirmative action. But that vote did not come at all to him. In fact, at the last minute, Clinton went round all of the areas where the white working class was expected to come, and he made terrific rabble-rousing speeches attacking Romney as Bain Capital, Mr. Vulture Capitalist, the man who wants to fire people and has probably fired you. And that meant that he was, of all people likely to win that crucial swing vote that might go Republican, he was the last man to do it. And he didn't do it. They got 59% of that vote, which for recent times is a poor performance.
It should have been 85%.
Oh, well, actually, if it had been 62%, he would have won, actually. So,
yeah, right. New topic, the end of exceptionalism. Joan, I'm quoting you, quote, we've been talking about Mitt Romney as a candidate, poor campaign in some way, done. Changing demography, changing ethnic makeup, all right. But what about the cultural changes? Jonah, quote, one of the stark lessons of Obama's victory is the degree to which the Republican Party has become a party for the married and religious. Marriage has gone out of style, and religion is waning dramatically. Explain.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the same argument, is that, if you just had married voters, or never mind married religious voters, Romney wins in a runaway landslide.
Right.
And part of the point I was making about these people who don't have these attachments to the civil society, don't have a lot of social capital in terms of familial or community organizations or religious institutions that they can draw inspiration from or draw strength from, their relationship is basically just with the state. That is very much like what we've seen in Europe, where, you know, the churches are subsidized, but they're all empty. And the electorate that, it turns out that the more you make you have a deracinated, alienated electorate, the more it looks like a European electorate, and the more that electorate will elect a European-like government. And I think that is sort of, and that has been the point of progressivism for over a century, was the Europeanization of American politics, to move from the sort of Lockean understanding of a government as this contractual relationship between sovereign citizens and the government to a European understanding of the state, which is this all-inclusive sort of Hegelian notion that replaces the absolutism of feudal Europe, that controls and takes responsibility for the progress of society in toto, sort of Locke versus Rousseau. And we are moving towards Rousseau.
John, I feel no impulse to assault your good cheer.
Yes.
But I'm afraid we are doomed, and here's why. Because whereas, as you quite rightly pointed out, we've always before been able sooner or later to assimilate immigrant groups and turn them into Americans, we were able to do so at a time when certain values were taken for granted. Marriage was understood as a vital institution. The family was understood as the central unit of society. Religion was understood as a fundamental part of civic life, and that has all begun to dissolve.
Before I address that point, I'll make one very quick point. The country is heading for a major smash-up, and it could well be that Obama is the Harold Hoover. It happens to be Harold Hoover in 1928 Herbert Hoover, in 1928 rather than in 1929 and 31.
Okay. And even that prospect cheers you up, doesn't it?
It doesn't cheer me up because it's going to be miserable, maybe miserable for me for all I know, see? So I don't welcome it. But it is an electoral fact of the greatest importance because a Republican majority that looked as secure as the Democratic one today was destroyed by the Depression. And that's an important fact. But the more important point is to address what you said. You see, it seems to me that the American people have changed in important ways, not all of them corrupt, as you were suggesting. And one of them is that they remain moral traditionalists, but they are tolerant and compassionate moral traditionalists. And we have always had to address, we are realists in the conservative, but the facts of life are conservative. And when you face a moral breakdown, marital instability, the breakdown of the family, and the consequences that this has for poor single women, or indeed for moderately rich single women, then you can no longer, as you would have done if we were Victorians, approach them like scolds and say, you know, you've made the wrong decisions, you know, and you must have. No. I mean, more and more, popular culture is a culture of understanding and sympathy, and that is a good thing. But it does mean that from a political standpoint, when we deal with social problems, when we address single women, and when we address single men, and we have to scold single men a bit more than single women, but even there, we have to understand the situation. We will approach them more effectively if we make it plain that we do actually care about their situation, that we're not doing it from the standpoint of saving money. We're doing it from the standpoint of saying to a single mother who's stuck on in an old building without a proper lift and worried about how she's going to pay the bill. You know, we've got to make it plain, A, we understand her situation, B, we care about it, and we care about her children, and finally, we are going to find ways of making it more possible for her to live independently in society, and that means thinking about her situation at a deeper level than simply about whether she's receiving welfare.
I want to push back on this just a tiny bit. I mean, I agree with you that we're an open and we're an tolerant society, and we're more open-minded than we were in the past, but you can be so open-minded, your brain falls out. And, Charles Murray's new book, I think, one of the coming apart, it's a wonderful book in a lot of ways, but the thing I took away most, I think took most to heart, is the way elites in America absolutely refuse to preach what they practice. Right? Marriage is perfectly healthy among the upper class. Even religion is down, but it's not nearly as down as with the lower classes in some respects. But there is nobody in the upper, very few people in the upper classes have any, I'm not saying necessarily to condemn single mothers, but to find some way to find the language to say that intact two-parent families are preferable to being a single mother. Finding out ways to sort of set an ideal. No one can live up to an ideal. That's why they're called ideals. But figure out that language, because otherwise it's just a mess.
I want to come in on this because I'm absolutely sure, Jonah, that you, and even you, Peter, there's been some point in your life where you've let someone down badly, and the person you let down came in and gave you a really stern talking to, and you suddenly looked at your behavior from a different standpoint. And that is exactly what we have to do. But that actually means that you are caring for the person.
That's true.
And so what I'm saying that's is fair. When so, we address so them, John, we're not just saying, you know, you're fine, you're terrific. No, right. The opposite.
Okay, so again, back in the Reagan speechwriting shop, we used to say to ourselves, as a voter is making up his mind about the politician, he's not just saying, what do I think of that politician? At some deep level, the voter is saying, what does that politician think of me? And everybody had the feeling that if they sat down for a beer with Ronald, if Ronald Reagan knew the worst about me, about the times that... somehow you had the sense that Ronald Reagan would say, I'm just wondering, this is on the way to, this is actually this is kind of a discourse, but I'm just wondering, we hear that Mitt Romney failed to connect because he was so wealthy, but I just sort of wonder whether he was too good. In some ways, he seemed not to have people who were a single mother or somebody who, Americans messed up in all kinds of ways. This guy has no experience of drug abuse, divorce, all the things that many Americans live through. So when people say he doesn't understand me, it wasn't he's too rich. In some ways, he's too good. Does that make any sense?
Well, it makes some sense.
All right, we can edit the whole thing out. But that was going nowhere. I was just wondering what you'd say.
But
go ahead.
But Margaret Thatcher was someone who you would have... the electorate had confidence. She knew what to do, and she knew how life should be led. Nobody thought she was a soft touch. And she was a kind of a stern nanny, but people responded to that in a different way, but as much as they did to Reagan's appeal, which is a more sympathetic appeal.
Yeah, I'm more sympathetic to Peter's position on this. I think Mitt Romney had what I've been calling for a long time, an authentic inauthenticity problem. He seems fake, but that's actually him, you know? It's sort of like when you see an alligator for the first time and you say, there's no way that's real. And then you lean over and see it moving. Whoa, it's real. Alligators just look fake. Mitt Romney just looks fake. He seems inauthentic. And it was a real problem for him in a way that I think if you had a different candidate who had the same wealth, maybe even the same business background, but was a little more organic, you know, didn't refer to his love of sport, you know, without the S at the end, you know, that sort of thing. It would have helped. I'm not saying it was, but the most just to get to your basic point, the most glaring statistic, or one of those glaring statistics that come out of the election results, is I can't remember the exact numbers, but who would be better on the economy? Mitt Romney wins. Right. Who would be better commander in chief? It's like a tie. Who would be better on leadership? Basically a tie. Who cares more about you? Barack Obama, 81% to Mitt Romney, 19%. And this is, you know, one of the great temptations, siren songs of punditry, is to think that your personal political or policy preferences would make for good politics. And I loathe the explosion of concern in American politics. My last name's Goldberg. I'm an Old Testament guy. I like my smiting and wrath, you know. But it's a fact of American politics that it works. I mean, Hillary Clinton ran as a carpetbagger for the Senate in New York on the campaign promise. She kept telling people, don't ask who's got more experience. Ask yourself, who is more concerned about the issues that concern New Yorkers? And that won her a Senate seat. And to me, I find that disgusting. I mean, in my core, I find that, you know, would you rather have a surgeon who's fairly blasé about your appendectomy because he's got a tea time, or a plumber who's deeply concerned about how to do an appendectomy but doesn't know how to do it? And yet we have this sort of thing in our culture now that's so touchy-feely, so built up in victimology, in this idea of the nanny state, that the nanny state has to care about me, and it works in politics. And Mitt Romney is so far out of that mainstream that he can't fake it in a way that even a Mitch Daniels or somebody else might have been able to.
Okay.
But there's one set of circumstances where that appeal cuts no ice, and that is when the roof is falling in.
Which leads me to John O'Sullivan, quote, this is waterfalls ahead, waterfall ahead, quote, an irresistible political force is about to meet an immovable economic object. We are on the edge of a vertiginous fiscal cliff. Explain.
very simple. Obama has just been elected on a platform of abundance for all. And he's promising all his constituencies, except promising all his constituencies a better life, continuation of the welfare programs, the entitlement programs, to be paid for by the very rich. First of all, if you took every penny away from the very rich, it wouldn't pay for the programs. Secondly, we are borrowing enormous amounts from other countries and other people to sustain this program. We are at the moment facing a situation in which they are not going to keep writing the checks in order to pay our bills. And secondly, the whole international financial system is put at risk by what's happening in the Europe with the collapse of the euro. So not only do you have a situation in which you've overpromised, you're not even be able to do the things that we already do in the future, and therefore the whole Obama program will be exposed as a hoax, unless the Republicans cooperate. What they should do is they should say to Obama, right, you won, we'll implement your program, you have total responsibility for it, and stand back.
Well, can I just say, on the fiscal cliff, the timing matters a great deal.
Oh, yes.
You both feel confident that it has to happen sometime within the next 4 years. He can't just slide past this one and leave it to his successor. Do you feel confident of that?
Yes.
You do?
Yeah, I mean, the fiscal cliff, I mean, we're speaking about it in metaphorical terms, but also the actual policy debate in Washington.
We are in for a crisis that everybody in the whole country will feel, and it will happen within 4 years.
I think so.
Okay, so.
Buy gold.
We know, because of the Woodward book, that John Boehner came this close to a grand bargain, raised taxes and cut spending with Barack Obama. Barack Obama scotched it. On Fox News Sunday, no less a figure than our friend Bill Kristol said, I don't see why the Republicans don't go ahead and sign on to this tax hike for millionaires. Should the GOP be the party defending millionaires? I don't really think so. So this goes to exactly what you were suggesting. Do you simply say, no, here is our position. We're going to wait for the country to come back to us because a crisis will send Americans to our arms. We will simply wait. Or do you maneuver and deal and make compromises? What do you do? If you're John Boehner, if you're actually an office holder who still has a majority in the House.
I think John Boehner's expressed position is actually basically the correct one, is that the compromise, if you're going to actually come up with a compromise on this, I mean, not taking John's suggestion, you know, put John's suggestion aside, of you can actually raise a lot of revenue by simplifying the tax code. And I would personally wouldn't mind paying net more in taxes if my tax preparation wasn't the Byzantine nightmare that it is, because I put a time value, there's a time value to my time, you know, and or money value to my time, and the complexity, the rent seeking, the distortions in the economy, those have costs, and so I think the actual policy preference that Mitt Romney basically ran on, I don't know if it's 20%. I mean, those things can be figured out, but flatten it, simplify it. If rich people end up paying net more, that would be fine with me. I'm also sort of, I'm sympathetic to Bill's position simply because...
Bill Kristol.
Yeah, Bill Kristol's position. Because, first of all, it's not clear to me that the millionaires, with the exception of these independent small businessmen, who are hugely important, and it's where the real job creation comes from, but everyone else, you know, the sort of salaried millionaires and are either Wall Street guys or Hollywood guys, and they're either not...
No, but they're talking about it'll kick in at
$250. That's true. I think Bill...
Okay, you're John Boehner. We'll give you, you're a dictator of the Republican Party. You lay it out for us for the next 4 years.
Well, first of all, I agree with quite a lot of what Jonah has said there, and I agree that, for example, that the kind of policy compromise he's suggesting would probably be, in other political circumstances, a perfectly reasonable thing to do. But, you know, there ought to be some justice in this world, even if there's never going to be very much. And we can't have a situation in which you run on a campaign of dissimulation and lies, and then you come together with your opponents, you agree on a compromise. The compromise in our current circumstances seems to me cannot produce good results. It may produce less bad ones. Mm-hmm. And then you own 50%, or given Obama's skills, 50% of the catastrophe, maybe more, maybe 70 or 80. So my view is that you say to Obama, look, show us what you want to do. Put it on the table. And then you say, okay, well, you won. So we're accepting the Democratic verdict. You put that through, we won't oppose it. And then you stand back.
But how does that get through the House? I mean, you're not going to get Republicans to vote for
it. Yes, you might abstain.
Oh, I see. That would be a...
And have the Obama policy go through. Of course, you don't tell him in advance of asking him to put it on the table that you're going to do this.
Right.
He'll put some kind of reasonable version out in order to win your support. Then you say, okay, you do it. And then you sit back, and what happens? I think, not the next 4 years, well before that, we're going to have serious problems. And this is going to expose the fraudulence and the incompetence of the present administration. And at that point, the game becomes a different game.
Okay, so Republicans, one more quotation here. Soon to be former, alas, Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana, quote, "As we ask Americans to join us on a boldly different course, it would help if they liked us just a bit." It sounds, John, as though you're outlining a strategy under which Republicans should simply stand there with their arms crossed and wait until they can say, "We told you so. Now will you listen?" But that's not very likable.
Well, what you're saying is, we're going to give you what you voted for. And I think that's a perfectly legitimate position. Now, obviously, you don't say to them, we're looking forward to this producing chaos and all night. and if there were a policy that didn't produce some chaos and all night, I'd be for that policy. But I think chaos and all night is in our future, and we simply have to work out what the best form of it is and how the Republic can best emerge from it as quickly as possible.
All right, boys. Final question.
I just know this tape's going to be played back when the Republicans do this, and I want him to get all the blame for it. Or credit.
That's John O'Sullivan. Just lost. Demographic problems. Cultural problems. We're not likable. In this 236th year of the Republic, final question. Give me your best reason for optimism about the United States of America. Jonah?
Oh, gosh, there are a lot of them. Look, I think it was Eugene McCarthy who said, America can choke on a gnat, but it can swallow tigers whole. And there is this capacity in the American people, after they screw up a lot of other things, to paraphrase Churchill, to get to the right place. And moreover, this is one of the things I did not like about Mitt Romney's campaign, is that he had this sort of pose in the convention speech where he said, I was disappointed that Barack Obama's program didn't work. I had hoped it would. If you're an actual conservative, your response is, of course it wasn't going to work.
Right.
We don't believe in this sort of Keynesian money vomiting around the nation. And if you actually have the core convictions, and the three of us have spent basically our professional lives around these core convictions, we wouldn't hold these core convictions if we didn't think they were true. And eventually, as Edmund Burke says, example is the school of mankind and he will learn it no other. Eventually, either reality proves that we're right in some capacity or another, or we've got to rethink our positions. And if we think these ideas are the correct ones, you got to have some optimism about it. And where else but America is that process more likely to be borne out?
John?
20 years ago, Manka Olson, the economist, wrote a terrific book called The Rise and Decline of Nations. And he pointed out that a nation which has a long period of political stability, America certainly has had that, tends to develop an overlapping series of rent-seeking arrangements, special privileges, restrictive practices, which collectively more and more burden the economy and divert wealth from the people who produce it to others. And this system, although it's bad economically, although it depresses growth, nonetheless, it suits people in powerful positions. So it's very difficult to get rid of it. And when he asked the question, how do nations get out of this? He looked at Japan, he looked at Germany, elsewhere. He concluded that there are two ways of doing it. The two easiest ways are to be defeated in war or to have a civil war in which one side wins and replaces the old system. Now, I don't recommend defeat in war, or I certainly don't recommend the civil war, which is worse. But Mrs. Thatcher did manage to achieve the same effect by a campaign that was tough and which was aided by the fact that things went very badly in 1979 when she came into office. So what I'm saying is that one of the great benefits of chaos and all night, of things going seriously wrong, is that people become realistic. They face facts, they change bad policies, they adopt brave new ones. And when they do that, the system changes. America is absolutely certainly capable of undergoing such a kind of revival, as Britain turned out to be, and as I hope Britain will turn out to be again, by the way. But these things don't happen unless you have a really severe test, and unless the alternative seductive policies not only don't work, but visibly are seen not to work. So I believe that we will get out of it, yes.
John O'Sullivan, Jonah Goldberg, thank you. At Sea with National Review, for Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.